As you and I are speaking, there is a House committee that is meeting about the budget. House Speaker Michael Madigan called this very special oversight panel because of, he said, decisions that you've made about the budget and his concerns about what you consider essential and not. So I actually am going to play somebody who works for the DCFS and works with children that are in the program for 18 to 21-year-olds that you've proposed cutting funding for.
How do you tell a kid, the last person in your life that has shown you that they will help you is about to drop you? These kids sitting at this table with me have been given up on by everybody in their lives. And I have to now tell them, hey, the state, your parent is also about to kick you out at 18. So your goals, your dreams, your hopes, good luck with that, because now you're on your own.
And she was sitting next to a 17-year-old who said that he'd been caged, who said that he had been in a coma for several months and had no family visit him, and DCFS was the only place he had to go, and he depended on that support. So can you answer her question?
Well, I feel terrible that we've had to have cuts. Cuts hurt people. They're terrible. The reality, though, is we inherited a $1.6 billion budget hole from Pat Quinn with a fundamentally dishonest budget, and we just don't have the resources. We've got to live within our means. And my goal, my personal commitment, is to turning the state around fundamentally, shrinking the bureaucracy so we can put more money into social services, so we don't have to have the types of cuts that we're making now, and that we can support the most disadvantaged, the most vulnerable, the most discriminated against among us. I'm committed to doing that. I wish I could snap my fingers and have it done today. It takes a bit of time. Democracy works at its own pace, but we're going to get through this. We're going to get our turnaround agenda done, restructure government, shrink the bureaucracy so we can put the money back into our economy to grow jobs, but also back into social services where they need to be.
But Governor, I mean, in the meantime, what about individuals such as this? You ran, said that there's too much waste, there's government inefficiencies, and further, you've said that crisis such as these cuts creates opportunity for negotiations. So is this basically, this child, for example, a negotiating tactic, or why not be open to revenue increases now and then go forward and promote your turnaround agenda so you can get the money so that these programs don't have to be cut right away?
Well, emphatically not. This person, these cuts are not part of a negotiating tactic. We committed, along with all the members in the General Assembly, to try to fix the budget crisis without having to borrow or raise taxes right now. And the money is in the government. We had recommended sweeping more special purpose funds that aren't critical, that where the money is not needed, and put it into more of the social services like this program.
This is a cut for next year. The DCFS, for example. This is just one of many examples.
Okay, so there's cuts, okay, for this year and for next year. For next year, what we've said is help us get the turnaround agenda passed. We could do it right now. That will free up resources, so not nearly as many cuts have to be made, and many of the programs that folks depend on can be protected and restored.
Part of your turnaround agenda is these local empowerment zones that would allow municipalities, counties, even Chicago wards to establish themselves as right to work. However, you had told voters when you were running for this office that right to work was not a priority. When did you change your mind?
Well, it's always right from the very earliest days. In fact, I wrote an op-ed, I believe it was in the Chicago Tribune, or maybe it might have been Champaign, in a paper talking about empowering local communities to decide if they want to compete against Indiana and Michigan and Tennessee and Texas for factory jobs, manufacturing and transportation jobs. I've been saying it all along. It's not the highest priority. We've said that voter empowerment, local control, that's the top priority. For those folks who would like to be able to compete for these empowerment zones, that's an option. We just want to have it be on the table. And we want, we're not insisting that it happen in any particular community. We just want local voters to be empowered to decide for themselves.
Why don't we hear about that, though, during the general election? I know we heard these labor bosses was often out of your mouth during the primary, but then it went away during the general election. Why is that?
Well, we talked about it all through. Now, I don't remember particular timing of emphasis. Obviously, clearly there's a lot of issues to talk about.
So it wasn't a conscious effort?
No, the effort is to get voters empowered, get local control, and clean up the conflicts of interest and corruption in the system. That's been the consistent message throughout. That's what our agenda is really about. And the particular segments of it are all part of the conversation.
Can you explain why it is that you believe so much in local voters? Obviously, these are the same voters that elected you statewide, elected members to the General Assembly. So why not continue having the state as a platform? Why do you trust local voters more?
Because our state government has been taken over by special interest groups, and it'll be much harder for the special interest groups to control every community. So if we break up the power structure, restore voter empowerment, restore local control, the special interest groups will be weakened and government will be more responsive. You know, democracy is designed to be a local issue, local voters controlling their own lives. I believe local voters should decide what gets collectively bargained in their government. Their government works for them. It's owned by them. It's not owned by government unions. It's owned by the voters and the taxpayers. School districts should decide what gets collectively bargained by the voters and the taxpayers, not by the teachers' union. The teachers' union and some of the government unions control Springfield, but they don't control the local governments, and that's where the power should be and the decisions should get made. That way we can improve our schools, we can keep taxes, especially our property taxes, more reasonable, and each community can decide whether they want to compete for manufacturing jobs against Tennessee and Texas and Indiana and Michigan and the other flexible employment states.
It seems that there may be a disconnect between your wanting to give voters all of this power on one hand, and yet when you were elected, there were two statewide referenda that you don't seem to support, both for this so-called millionaire's tax as well as for a minimum wage that would bring it to $10, not by 2022, but right away. So why go back on what voters wished for then, but want to give them these powers for things that you desire?
Those are both more big government things. Those are more dictation from Springfield. And that's what I'm fighting against. This is just freeing up the people away from big government. That's what our whole agenda is about. I've said I'm open to raising the minimum wage. But we want to do that, though, while we're making Illinois more competitive, because what we can't do is hurt our economy and cause more job losses and more unemployment. So we've got to be careful when talking the minimum wage. I'll be supportive of it, but we need to also change workers' comp, unemployment insurance, the tax system, so our businesses can compete. And when it comes to taxes and this millionaire tax, here's a big issue. We have got to grow our economy, and just raising taxes on successful business owners, that's going to push more jobs out of the state. And when people say, but we got to do it because we need a more progressive income tax, that we need wealthy paying their fair share, I just say, look at the other states who've done it, especially like New Jersey and other similar states to Illinois. They've done it. They've pushed successful people out, and New Jersey is just like us. They have high property taxes. They have a graduated income tax. And they can't even pay their pensions.
Graduate
income tax isn't the answer.
Because you've said these things before, and our time, unfortunately, is limited. I could sit down with you for quite a while. Speaking of successful people, you're one of them, and you have $20 million that is in your own campaign fund. There's also now the Illinois Turnaround PAC. Can you explain what you hope to achieve through this new committee? And further, can you talk about, you know, why is it that when labor and trial lawyers donate to politicians, you say that that's a special interest, but when you, Ken Griffin, Dick Uihlein donate, that it is not a special interest?
I and the donors to the various entities that we're raising money for don't contract with the state. We don't do business with the state. We are not making more money from the state. We're just taxpayers. And we've got to fight for taxpayers. Hardworking families in Illinois pay huge property taxes and high income taxes, and we're trying to get value for taxpayers. That's what our agenda is about. The reality is trial lawyers make money from more regulations and bigger government. They make a lot of money from it. And government unions, they contract 100% with the state, and the higher the taxes and the bigger the bureaucracy, the more the government unions make. So it's a conflict of interest. That's the battle we've got to take on.
This turnaround pack, or what's the plan for that?
Well, the turnaround pack is going to focus on supporting members of the General Assembly who will take on the special interests and vote to do our turnaround agenda and get our state back on a good trajectory, and it will oppose and campaign against the legislators who are really aligned with the special interests of big government and higher taxes and conflicts of interest. We're going to have a tough battle in the future on these issues, and we want to make sure that the legislators who are about reform and good government, empowering local voters, getting local control of these issues, that those legislators are helped in their elections.
Does that nonetheless, however, entice legislators who may have a differing opinion on some of these issues? They're not corrupt. They just have a different viewpoint on where the state should go and how it can best get there, to have to go outside the bounds to spend more money collecting contributions because they don't have their own personal fortunes to rely on.
Well, each legislator will decide how they want to vote and who they will seek support from. Our point is donations from groups that make money from government and who contract with the state and negotiate with many legislators or with governors, those folks shouldn't be making political contributions. And frankly, legislators shouldn't be taking money from those groups because it's a conflict of interest with our taxpayers, our homeowners, our small business owners. That's the problem we've got to take on.